If you or a loved one has a hoarding problem, let's work together on a solution.
Thank you for stopping by the Hoarding Solution Podcast. I'm really happy to be talking today with Richard Kaufman, and he is an author, veteran, podcast host, and we've chatted before, but we have some things in common that kind of draw us together, and Richard is also very much responsible for the fact that I have a podcast in the first place. So thank you for being here today.
Thank you so much for having me, and I'm so grateful to be here. You were the first person ever on my podcast, and I think it's the second or third time I've been on yours, so I'm just grateful to be here.
I'm happy to have you here and chatting, and I love all the positive energy you put out despite challenging circumstances that you're in, so it's very encouraging to me to see people I know progressing forward. It's very inspiring.
Well, sometimes it feels like it's two steps forwards, three steps back sometimes. So, you know, sometimes it's the people that you think are the strongest that are sometimes.
Exactly. And I like the things that say, you know, check on your strong friends, you know, because strength and resilience is important, but sometimes you need to be able to be vulnerable with people who get it. And, you know, I know some people talk about social media as in a very negative way, but I was thinking about, well, why do I use it? Partially it's to connect with people, right? And sometimes it's to be inspired or to feel like you're not alone. And so can I get stuck in a loop of watching, you know, cat and dog videos? Yeah. But sometimes that's also a respite from whatever's going on in your life. So I'm trying to empathize with the fact that for some of us, this is how we connect. And especially over the past few years, like what else was there? Like I talked to all kinds of people because of our limitations. So I don't know. Sometimes I think, well, it's just like any other tool, right? The internet is a tool to use, hopefully for the good of others.
Well, for the people that shit on social media, you know, they're also the people that are watching negative stuff. And like Ed Milet taught me, you know, you're using your reticulator activating system, whatever you look for, you're going to find. So if you're looking for the good in social media, you know, so what I did is I switched up my whole social media for one whole month straight. I just hit everything positive and let everything negative go. And just like the algorithm in your mind, once you start hitting everything that's positive, it's only going to show you more of what you've already liked. So if you like positive stuff, positive is going to come in your life. Negative stuff, negative is going to come into it. So it all depends on your thought process and how you set up your social media.
And it's like your shirt says there, what today I decide. What are you deciding today? Are you, you know, I found myself a couple days ago, like, I got up and I was growly as soon as I got up. And I'm like, I just slept in a warm bed. Like, what's my issue? You know? So I had to really check what I was saying. Cause like the first three things were like really growly and grumpy. And I'm like, what's this? Like, I don't need this today. And deciding you're going to change that thought, change that mindset into, you know, I was recently on the Swendingo Files podcast.
Great podcast. Awesome podcast.
And it was a really cool, like, conversation, I feel, about, like, you know, where I came from, whatever. And I listened to Stevens, the host's episode first. And it was just really interesting to hear his story and how he came to be where he's at. But one of those things that I talked about there was about your mindset and how, when I went into boot camp, my attitude is I will not fail because I didn't feel like I had other options. But later, I mean, you're like we're talking years later, I finally figured out that that was actually kind of a negative way to go into that scenario versus I will succeed. And so over time, I have changed that to, oh, I will succeed. And, at the time, it didn't occur to me that it was that negative because I just saw the military as a survival mechanism, basically escaping from a horde and the chaos and dysfunction. So, anyway, I go into more of it on there, but I just appreciate the aspect that he's providing, which is tell us your story and tell us what you're doing now and what things helped you with your transition. So I just think that's a great way to get more military to talk about it, whether they're entrepreneurs or business or, whatever you're doing, if you have a job or raising your kids, like I think it's a great platform to talk about what your story is. So.
But I also love, when you're talking about the mindset, and I've dug very deep into the mindset in the last year or so. And, I've talked to millionaires, billionaires, and every one of them said to me, everybody's talking about what they don't want instead of what they do want. Instead of saying, oh, I don't want somebody to cheat on me as a spouse, why not talk about, I do want a husband that's going to love me and care for me and take care. You know what I mean? So stop talking about things that we don't want and start talking about things that we do want. Because whatever you say, it's going to become, just like Mr. Carnegie said in 1900, your obsessions, I mean, your obsessions become your possession. Whatever you talk about is what will happen.
And it's so, I saw something the other day about where you're at now. You want a year ago, you wished you were there, and now you are. And so be grateful for where you're at now. And I realized for me, that's very true that I'm in a position where I don't have to commute. I don't have to deal with people on the days I don't want to. And I can be very, particular about my energy and where I'm expending it. And I mean, I live on a farm again, basically. And so some days I'm podcasting and talking and interviewing, and other days I am shoveling, the goose pen. So I mean, there's variety now, but I have more time and more freedom to do some of those things which I didn't have before. So I'm learning to manage it a little better. I'm a work in progress constantly, but even this morning, getting set up to do this, and I'm in a different spot, and the Wi-Fi wasn't working somewhere else. And so it's just like, okay, how do we make this work? And I had support. Ron, my boyfriend, was there, making sure everything's moving, and the heater's not working, but whatever. I have a wool sweater. Like, most important was, hey, will the Wi-Fi work? Can I deal with it for an hour? Yeah. So, it's just a matter of kind of figuring out what's going to work today. And some days I'm better at navigating that than others. So.
Well, like my friend David Meltzer says, he said that gratitude and anger cannot occupy the same spot, the same space. So you can't be angry if you're filled with gratitude. And it's not always easy to be have a lot of gratitude, but sometimes when you think to the nitty gritty, well, shit can always be worse. So, sometimes when you start thinking like that, you're like, yeah, because like my dad, he came from Italy on a boat. And he always used to tell me that, the man with no shoes can't complain to the man with no feet. So you kind of, so it's all about perspective sometimes.
And finding, I have probably way too many little motivational signs in my space, but one of those th one sign I have is celebrate the little things. And sometimes that's all we've got. It's that hot cup of coffee. It's that, oh, someone said, hey, I'm thinking of you. Like all those things can really add up some days. And some days that's what you're doing. You're going from little thing to little thing. Ooh, warm bed. Ooh, hot coffee. Oh, hot shower. I got to take a long walk with the dog. Like it's those little things that really can make a difference for us. And being grateful about that is very helpful to me. And you're right. I can't be angry and, oh, look, I'm so grateful. It's a matter of deciding how you're going to look at it, you know, and some days that's easier than others.
And I think sometimes when you switch to, I have to do something to, I get to do something, it totally switches the whole parameters.
Right. And when you're engaged in some of these things, that is really helpful. Hey, I get to be in a position to help this person today or have this conversation or whatever. And it is definitely a more positive way to walk around, I believe.
Yeah.
So we're still having snow where I'm at. It's ridiculous to me. And so, you know, there's some mindset for me right there is like, will spring ever show up? So I don't know what you all are dealing with out there, but man.
Well, today it's 65 degrees. I got up this morning, it was 45. So I got on my hoodies and my sweat and I went for an hour and a half walk listening to my audio books. So today's been a great day. I'm not going to complain. I'll take it any way I can get it. And even if it whatever happens, you know, somebody didn't wake up today. So right. As long as I can wake up, my eyes open, I can see something, you know, with my blindness and everything. If I can see something, I give God praise before my feet hit the floor. I'm going to have a good day regardless, whatever happens, because I made it through the night.
Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, you're right. Some people didn't wake up today. And they had plans and people and I think it points to the fact that we need to live right now and we need to be aware of what we have right in front of us. And I tend to think too far ahead sometimes versus just, hey, how am I doing right now? What can I take a walk? A couple days ago I did and I slept like a rock. And it's more about how did I sleep than, hey, I'm exercising for whatever reason. It's like, how did I sleep? Oh, much better because I got off my, you know.
You know, I talked to my sister when I was down there. We had dinner together. And mm-hmm. I said, you know, and I told her, I said, you know, time, you control time. She's like, what do you mean? I said, I can't reach back and touch yesterday. So yesterday does not exist. Tomorrow does not exist. The only thing I can do is touch right now, touch this moment. Mm-hmm. And I think the more that we live in the moment, the better future we're going to have because we're actually enjoying and doing the next right thing now instead of worrying about the past and all the junk that happened in the past because it doesn't exist. In reality, the past doesn't exist. You can't touch it.
And we
so
can't
it's over.
Change it. Know? You know, you can't do anything about what happened before. And so I find in families, at least in my experience, that a lot of times people are stuck in a certain, we'll call it a soundtrack, over and over and over again. That's where they're at. That's how they remember me as a kid. I'm like, do you know how old I am now? Like, I am not the same person anymore. And I can see that you aren't either. You have changed. We're all aging. Hello. You know, we've all evolved in some way. Now, granted, their mindset may have not changed at all, but mine has. And so my approach, my boundaries, what I'm willing to say, how I'm willing to show up with those people has changed a lot. And that can be very isolating if you're trying to lead the way for healing or less chaos or less trauma in your family dynamics. And I just think you can't operate at the same level that you were at when you're 12, when you're in your 50s. Like, it's just not going to work if you're trying to be a different person. And I think that's something that I have found with my own mom is she is very much in the past. And I'm like, how old am I? How old are you? Like, do you know that 30 years have passed since this thing you're talking about? Like, I don't live there anymore. You know, I don't look at it the same way. I, don't even think about it most of the time. Now, are there things that prompt it? Are there things that make me have some sort of flashback or mental moment where I'm like, oh my God, you know? Yeah. But do I live there? No. And I think that's what's hard when you come into it as a caregiving role or just an advocate or whatever for someone who's really been difficult for you most of your life.
All right, so we're gonna go a little bit deep. We're gonna talk about stuff that's not exactly positive, but you know, I grew up, as you know my story, I grew up as an abused child. I was homeless a couple times, all of my own doing. I admit 100% whatever happened, it was my fault. But my mother's response was, when I needed help and I went to her for help, her response was, well, you made your bed, you lie in it. And now that she's 78 years old, coming down with dementia, needs somebody to take care of her since Dad died Valentine's Day two years ago. Should I just say, hey, you made your bed, you lie in it? But for me, my dad's deathbed, he promised me to take care of Mom best that I can. And that's why I'm doing it, not because of the relationship with my mother and me. And she told me, you know, well, you should take care of me because I'm your mother. And I'm like, wait. I'm like, that doesn't fly. You know, I'm not, like you said, I'm not 8. I'm not 12. You know, I'm a grown man now with my own family. And, you know, just because you're, and I always say it all the time, you know, you are closer to me as a sister than my own sister is. Mm-hmm. You know, you're closer to me than my own family is. So, you know, blood, you know, just makes you relative. It doesn't make you family. So that's what I've been going with, trying to take care of my abuser. And I'm sure that many of the people that are listening to this, they understand that, but it doesn't get talked about.
And that's the thing, is it doesn't get talked about. The societal expectation that we'll take care of our blood relatives because we're blood, no matter how they treated us, is just so challenging to navigate through. It just, you're doing, like you said, you talked about it with your dad on his deathbed that you're going to do this thing. And that's kind of where I'm at. Like, yeah, okay, you are the person who brought me into the world. And there are positives that were involved with that. But by and large, there's a lot of negative too. And now I'm at a place where I'm going to try to do the right thing because I believe I should try to do the right thing. Not because I feel like this huge connection, you know, I'm more in that detached mode, really, because of the verbal assaults and abuse and straight up lies that start to show up, it seems, when people start down maybe the dementia path, maybe not quite, but just right on the cusp of the memory issues. And it's really hard to know you're doing the right thing, the best thing you can in that moment for that person, yet they aren't happy about it. And they're going to tell you all day long about the ways you screwed up instead of being grateful that you traveled, you took time away from your family, you made decisions to try to help them. And it's like, honestly, I think it's one of the more horrifying things I've experienced, is having someone you care, you know, or you wouldn't be doing it, but having someone berate you for the fact that you are doing the best you can is very, it's very hard to hear that. And it really can impact our mental health.
You know, and what drives me crazy, and I know it sounds crazy about going into the past, but it's just something, you know, like when I was deployed, not once did I get a care package, you know, from my parents. But now, you know, I'm sending Depends, you know, I'm sending gum, you know, all these packages and I'm like, wait a minute, I'm like, this, somehow it got twisted. I'm like, mm-hmm. That's not the way it should, because I got, you know, I got a child, one boy, in college, and we're always sending him stuff. We're always sending him care packages and making sure he got stuff, you know? And I'm like, but here I am doing this stuff for somebody that never even cared if I was alive or dead. So it's kind of, it's in a weird dichotomy, even though I'm not angry about it. It's just something that I'm looking at as a parent to make sure that I'm doing these things for my kids. You know what I mean? To stop that cycle of abuse.
And that's a conversation. So I don't have kids for a number of reasons, but I'm an auntie to other friends' kids and other people's kids. And I enjoy that role because I feel like you can be a positive force in a kid's life, in someone's life. So, but we've had the conversation, well, how come I didn't have kids? Would it have been different if my younger brother didn't have Duchenne's muscular dystrophy? I don't know how to answer that question. Could it have been different? Possibly. Did I have a conversation with him about this whole problem that he was dealing with? Yep. And he's like, if I knew potentially that I could have a kid that had this problem, I would not have a kid. And for me, that was kind of my answer. Like, well, that could potentially happen. So no. But having that conversation with my own mother is like, clearly you don't understand the reasoning behind my decisions. And not only do you not want to know, you don't even want to ask, you want to assume why I made these choices. And honestly, one of the methods that is helpful is gray rocking, where you be pretty boring in your interaction with someone who's abused you. You do what you can for them, but you stay pretty neutral and you don't get upset and you don't feed their anything, and you don't give them anything that they can use against you or talk about with other people. And it's kind of led me to more of the detached side of, hey, I'm going to do what I can here, but I'm also pretty detached from the outcome. You know, I'm pretty detached from the relationship, if you will. And I don't know if it's exactly healthy to do that long term, but I do know sometimes in the moment that that is the best way for you to approach the situation. And so you don't emotionally get all ramped up and ticked off.
Well, I mean, and like you said, you know, we've been friends for, I don't know, 8 years maybe. And I wear my heart on my sleeve. And, you know, last week I came close, really close to becoming a member of the 22. I came really, really close because I just felt like I had enough. And so, you know, a lot of us, you know, I always say, you know, you can't pour from an empty cup, you know, but eventually, you know, you have to start saying, all right, I need to start filling my cup or else I'm not going to be able to help anybody else. I'm not going to be any good to anybody else. And I think caregivers, we go through that where we become no good for anybody and including ourselves. And that's when we wear out. And sometimes the other person doesn't even care that you're wearing out. They just want to take.
And I will just say that I'm glad you're still here and talking with us and finding ways to come out on the other side of those thoughts. And, you know, it takes a lot to put yourself in a position where you're trying to help someone who's been basically horrible to you. And if you don't find ways to fill your cup, you will end up with basically a broken cup, as far as I'm concerned, because eventually you get angry enough to just bust that thing. And then what? You know, so I think caregivers, burnout is real, but I think it's another level of problem. Not only are you dealing with an elderly person, you're dealing with an elderly person that has verbally, maybe physically, other things, done things to you. And so when you're there doing the best you can in that caregiving role, despite all that, I think it's even harder to have someone verbally assaulting you and questioning everything you do and being very negative. It just adds another level of burnout, I think, when you're in a caregiving spot like that.
Well, for me, my hard part is I am an empath. You know, I feel everything that somebody else feels. So when I had to tell my mother, you know, you're never going back home again. You're never going back to your house. You're never going to sit on your couch again. You're never going to be in your yard again. That hurt me because I took on that pain. But then there's points where, you know, even my wife says, you didn't put her in this situation. She did not, they did not plan for any of this. And if, in, when they were younger, even though her sister told her, you need a plan, you need a plan. Her plan was, well, God's going to take care of it. Well, guess what? I'm God and I'm taking care of it. And I'm not a good guy. I'm a very bad guy, by the way. But for me, like I said, I'm an empath. So every pain she's feeling, I'm feeling it also. And sometimes as an empath, you're always thinking, well, is it my fault? Is it, you know, I take on all responsibility. So it's weird, you know, having to realize that, you know, you have dementia, you know, you're never going home. You're never going to go sleep in your bed again. It's stupid things, you know, never going to take a bath in your bathtub again. So for me, stuff like that, that's what kind of got to me, because I would, how would it feel if I know I can never go home to be with my wife again? I can never sleep in my bed. I can never go to my studio. How would I feel if I could never play my guitars again? So that's the way I started thinking about it. Then it's like, bro, it's not your fault. You didn't make any of this. You're just making chicken salad out of chicken shit.
you know, it's very valid. Like, you didn't put anyone in those positions. Though they chose it, and now you're dealing with the fallout, or the chicken shit, as it were. Because really, it can feel slimy and slippery and gross, and you really don't want to touch it, and you hope you don't fall down in it. And sometimes I would say we do. We get mad, we're human, you know, we get overwhelmed, I think. But I also see where, like you mentioned, your wife and the support role, where someone can give you an outside perspective and say, hey, hello, you didn't cause this, you know, don't beat yourself up so much, because I don't think we stop doing that. I just think someone who is watching out for us can look at that and say, hey, you know, pretty much you're doing what you can. You're doing the best you can given the circumstances, and no, this isn't something you created. You are trying to navigate it in the best way you know how. And I think it's Maya Angelou that says, you know, when you're doing the best you can, basically, and I'm obviously paraphrasing, but when you know better, you do better. And so you just do what you know right then, and then later you might learn there's a better way or a different way, and then you adjust and do it differently. But it's not like there's some rule book that says, hey, this is how you're going to deal with your parent that abused you. Like, where's that rule book, you know? And like you mentioned about being an empath, like, I can understand people's pain. Like, I understand my mom was in the foster care system. I understand that her mom was ill. I understand that she became a caregiver to my brother, not planning it. She became a caregiver to my dad. She did it for other people. Like, I can see where that trauma and that pain comes from for her. But it also doesn't excuse other behavior. Like, I can't just take everything I've experienced and just dump it on people all the time and expect to have, you know, good outcomes. And but I think it's very, like you're saying, we don't talk about this enough. We don't talk about the fact that sometimes people go into facility and there's a reason their family doesn't come there. Or they limit their contact.
But, like, you know, the name of the show is The Hoarding Solution. So let's talk about that a little bit. You know, my mother has no money in her bank account except for Social Security. And that's why she's in a position she's in. But she said she had no money, but we just had to junk her $60,000 motorhome with only 24,000 miles on it. But she let it go to waste and let it rot. And now it's trash. And I pulled 32 bags of garbage from her house. And I still have another 15 bags of clothes with that with the sticker still on them, shoes, pocketbooks. So, you know, when you start looking, okay, she says, well, I have no money. And then I'm like, but I just threw out 32 bags of shit and I still have 15 bags to donate. And they still have the, you know, they still have the stickers on them. They're still in the boxes, some of the stuff. And I'm like, and you just threw away a brand new motorhome. You know, so that's like $100,000 right there that you just wasted on hoarding shit. And it's not even good shit.
Right.
It was just bags everywhere. It was bags under the bed, in the closets, and every drawer there was bags of, I think she owned stock in Ziploc bags and pens. But, you know, me and my wife came down and she helped me do all this stuff. But you start thinking, wait a minute, you say you have no money. Well, here's the reason you don't have money, because it's all in crap. You know?
And you're destroying homes, campers, cars, and not to mention relationships with the amount of stuff. I mean, it's not unheard of to pull bags and bags of trash out of these situations. I mean, last year I pulled 22 contractor bags of trash out of my mom's camper so she could come home after surgery, which that's a whole nother conversation. But I will say that I had the support of a social worker at the hospital she was at, but still she was mad as heck, even though she agreed to it. But that's a lot of trash to be in a camper, you know, in a house, stuffed everywhere. And now you're stuck dealing with it, trying to figure out, is it good enough to donate? Or is it nasty enough that I just have to pitch it all? And it's not cheap, by the way, to haul some of that stuff off to the dump or wherever you're taking it. So, I mean, the cost of hoarding is very high when financially, not to mention emotionally and relationship wise. But I think that part of that solution is you do step in. Finally, at some point, you're able to step in and say, okay, I am going to be God on this situation. I am going to be the deciding factor here, because clearly you can't be. And that's where I think, if possible, earlier intervention, asking people, can they navigate their home after surgery, would be a good first step when someone's in a situation or they land in a hospital. And what I've seen is even the person with the hoarding issue might say, hey, I've got a hoarding issue. It's documented, but that's it. Nothing happens. Even though a medical professional has now been notified, nothing changes. And they send people home. The terminology is an unsafe discharge, knowing there's fall risks, knowing there's no running water, knowing they cannot cook on their stove. It's covered with newspapers and takeout containers, and they might have rodents, they might have other infestations. Like, how is it we can send someone back to that in a vulnerable state and basically say, well, they can live how they want? Okay, yeah, this is America. People can live how they want. But I almost feel like we don't care. Like, we don't care enough, and I'm speaking broadly as a society, to say, this older person should not live in this squalor. Like, what can we do to remedy this? And granted, they fight us all the way. I don't know if your mom was mad, but mine sure was, even though it was agreed on to clean out.
Well, like she went, well, my mother doesn't even know what's going on. I mean, she doesn't really know. She doesn't realize the place she's staying in is $5,000, $5,400 a month.
Wow.
You know, it's twice my mortgage. So she doesn't even realize that we had to sell the house, you know, until I started talking to her the other day. And I'm like, Ma, you've been here 6 months. That's $30,000 that right. You owe. And she's like, well, I didn't choose to be here. And my rebuttal was, well, because the state got involved because they had to come and take you to the hospital. If I would have brought you home and something would have happened in you, they're going to send you to a state facility wherever they want to put you. And then you become a ward of the state. So for me, I chose this way to put you in a better place for now, so you're safe until I can figure out a way to get you in a permanent place.
Right.
But I'm going to be the bad guy for selling the house, for selling the motor. I'm going to be the bad guy, and I know I'm going to be the bad guy, but I'm okay with that as long as I know that she's safe, that she's not harming herself. She's being fed. She's being bathed. She may not be happy all the time, but I choose safety over happiness 100% of the time.
And you don't, it, in some way, you don't want that coming back on you, that you are making the best decision for her safety and well-being. And my dad was pulled from the horde. This was quite a few years ago now. And he was hospitalized and sent to a nursing facility because he couldn't come back to that due to mobility issues, refusing medication, not eating. Like, but there wasn't a time that I visited him where he didn't say, hey, I want to go home. Hey, I want to go home to my recliner in the pile of trash. Like, that's what he was saying every time he said it, basically. That's what I heard. But the truth is that he was in a place, like you're saying, he's getting bathed and fed. He could have visitors. He was involved with some of the social programs there. For his quality of life, it was way better than the situation he had been in. But was he unhappy? Yeah. Was he safe? Yeah. Do people want to live in a nursing facility? No, because there goes so much of your freedom. But if you have a health issue, sometimes that's where you're going to end up, and there's not a whole lot you can do about it except go with it. And, you know, it's not cheap staying in those facilities. $5,000 a month is actually a lot less than some of the places I know of, where you're looking at 10 grand a month for basically food, shelter, and someone checking on them. But the other part of that is you can't bring that person into your home, right? Like, it would be way too much care, be way too much toll on your family. And it isn't because you don't care. It's because you care enough about your own family that you don't want to introduce that into your living space.
Not only that, and you know my wife, she's my best friend, my bride, but she knows all the abuse that my mother gave me. And my wife feels that. And my wife's like, she's not living in my house, or we're getting a divorce. That's it. Because she abused you as a child and growing up. You know, she's the one that said, you know, you make your bed, you lie in it. Well, you know, now she's going to have to kind of say, well, now she's going to have to figure out. But now, something that drove me crazy was last week, right before I came home back to New Jersey. She's in this beautiful place. It's all white. It's gorgeous. And then I open up a drawer and there's bags. And I flipped out. I'm like, even here, the insanity still. So no matter where she goes, the insanity is still going to follow. You know, like I say, I'm in recovery 34 years, that wherever you go, you bring you with you. So, you know, even though she's in a nice place, she still has that hoarding mentality. So I'm like, well, then I guess I can't really do anything. I can't just say, well, it was because she lived in this house for so long, blah, blah, blah. You know, she's only been there 5 months and there's still bags and Ziploc bags everywhere. And I'm like, it's the same shit. So it doesn't matter where she goes, it's going to be the same shit. And it's not going to happen to my.
Right. And you don't want that happening in your space. And this is the conversations I've had where I'm like, look, we take our trash to the dump, okay? Like normal people do. And you can fight it and argue it, but it's not yours and it's going to the dump. And yes, I regularly remove trash from my living space. Like, it's a concept a lot of people that hoard really struggle with. Like, what's trash? What isn't? But like you're mentioning, if the person doesn't recognize they have a problem and they're unwilling to deal with whatever reasons they have for hoarding, they're going to do it no matter where they are. And maybe they can't do it on a big scale, but napkins, cups, spoons, silverware, like all kinds of things, whatever it is they can hoard, they will. And then some people are getting evicted from, say, assisted living because they're hoarding again. And I know people who get the call that say, hey, come clean out your mom's place because it's getting bad. Again, how is it my issue? I didn't create that. Why am I being called to come and deal with it? Well, the expectation is the family is going to do something. And we often do, but often it's to our own detriment. And that's where your boundaries come in with how much am I willing to do? How much am I willing to clean out all the Ziplocs every time I come? Is she going to be mad every time I come? Maybe. And that's when it becomes, could someone else maybe be the bad guy in this particular scenario? You know? And I had the experience where, so a lot of times they're trying to get you to take the person home to their space. And then if something happens to them, people want to come back and say, well, you should have never brought them back to that space. Yeah, you're right. However, what was I going to do? And so now it's prudent sometimes to say, I will not be the person that brings them home. I will not be responsible for that. And if the hospital wants to be responsible for that unsafe discharge, that's on them. And sometimes you have to go to that level where you aren't going to be responsible for this person right after surgery or right after whatever is happening for them. And that's hard. It's really hard to say, hey, yeah, I'm here. I'm advocating for you. I'm doing the best I can. Oh, but by the way, you need to stay another day so I can go clean out your crap. Like, it is hard to be in that position when the truth is it should have been handled a long time ago, but that person wouldn't let you. So, and then, I mean, I was at a point where I would choose relationship over stuff, right? Okay, I just won't talk about the hoarding. I just won't talk about no running water. I just won't talk about, you know, the fact that these piles could be an avalanche at any time. But then, as I got healthier as a person, went through therapy, did these things, I became a parent where I would have to say something, but then back off and go home. Like, I couldn't not engage, I guess, but I had to figure out how to engage better. And sometimes that means you put them in a facility for a period of time and you let them get adjusted for a couple of weeks. You don't bug them every day. You don't call them. You let the people manage that person. And I think we're kind of trained to constantly be checking on them and constantly be engaged and constantly be concerned about their well-being. We're groomed that way, I think, in some ways. And when you're able to say, okay, that's not working anymore, they get angry, but I get sanity. Like, it's a trade-off. Sorry, got off on a tangent there,
No,
but
but
you
you know,
know.
one thing, it made me realize when I got home, because I know I'm a t-shirt freak. I mean, I got hundreds of t-shirts, and I'm like, I look at it and I'm like, I wear the same 10 t-shirts and 10 hats. What do I need with all this shit? Because I'm thinking, you know, I'm 54, you know, my wife's 50. And what are my kids? If this happens, something happened to us, my kids got to go through all my shit. So that's when I decided, all right, I need to start. You know, kind of just narrowing down a little bit, and get rid of some stuff that I have because I got way too much shit. So, and I started noticing there's tendencies, and I'm like, all right, I don't need to go down that road. I don't want to be in that same position, especially financially wise. So I'm actually learning while I'm going through this whole thing. And I think, you know, like Ed Milet says, you know, things don't happen to you. They happen for you, and everything is a teachable moment. So I'm actually using this as a learning curve for my future and my kids' future. You know what I'm trying to say? So
Yeah.
I'm not as angry because it's actually it's I'm being taught a lesson.
And I am getting better some days at looking at, okay, what can I learn from this? What can I take from this for me personally? And then what can I share? Because there's so many people struggling with this, and it's just difficult. I mean, we were talking about the fact that I'm a digital hoarder the other day, and I was like, you're right, I am. And I got too many emails. I've got this. I've got old files. I've got stuff. I mean, I've deleted a lot of things, right? But I still have a lot of stuff. But it's digital. It's still not great because it takes up a lot of storage and it's hard to hunt for things sometimes if you're looking for your logo or the most recent thing or whatever. But that tendency is there to just hold on to it because why? I might need it someday. And that's a very hoarder-esque statement. You know, I might need it someday. And I think, like for me, when I used to come and visit, now I live in very close proximity, but my stress response would be come home and clean my house till it's spotless, go through that box, do whatever thing I'd been delaying after a visit to some of the to the situation. It was like, okay, I can't allow this to get to that point. And I used to joke around that everybody has a junk room. Well, that can expand pretty quickly if you don't get a handle on it. So I don't have space for a junk room currently, and I don't really ever want one again, right? But it is about acknowledging, hey, I've seen this behavior. I've seen how it plays out for my mom or for my other relatives, or some people have kids that are hoarding, and that's a whole nother conversation, but it's really hard to overcome that sometimes, unless you're very super tuned into, hey, I don't want to repeat this. This, my attitude about it is that it ends here. The cycle ends here. I refuse to promote any kind of trauma, drama, mental health problems. Like, I don't want to be part of the problem. I want to be part of the solution. And I do believe that talking about this and having a more open conversations is a start to part of a solution. And earlier questions, earlier things that we can do so that someone isn't evicted because they have a hoarding issue. And I've seen it. It happens. And I see both sides of it, right? The person with the hoarding issue, there's the trauma, all the things that go to that. But on the other hand, you have a landlord or a property owner who's like, hey, you're destroying my stuff. You know, you're destroying my space. And how fair is that to the person who owns that property? It's not. And it's also not their responsibility to help their tenants get mental health help. But it's a component that would help someone be housed if they're willing to address that issue. And I see it a lot for veterans, older folks who collected a lot of stuff. And now I had someone, a situation where someone was about to be evicted. But the thing about it is, like, they had three inspections and people just kind of pushed it along for 3 years until someone said, hey, this is a problem. Can you help us deal with it? So why were you passing their inspections for the past 2 years? I don't understand. And a lot of times it's because they don't know what to do and they don't have a resource. And it can be expensive to hire someone to come in there and help someone sort through all their stuff. And my rule of thumb now is, if you or I went into a situation, we'd think, oh, this will take a couple hours. Well, if you're dealing with someone that has a hoarding issue, double it. It's always going to be twice the amount of time, at least, that you think it would take. So that's another part of having these conversations around how long is this actually going to take? And if it's took someone 15 years to get to this point, do you think they're going to fix it in 15 days? No. And so it's unreasonable expectations, but I believe in part it's because people setting those expectations don't understand what they're dealing with. And
but now you know, you've been in this space a long time, and it can't be just me noticing that Americans have too much shit. I mean, because they're putting up rental units everywhere and they're filling out and building more and more. So Americans got way too much stuff. And like a gentleman committed suicide yesterday. Hmm. And one of the honest posts that he put on social media, he says a lot of it had to do with financial. So I think a lot of us, you know, we get ourselves into these holes buying shit. That if we lived a little bit more simpler life and had one good car instead of three crappy cars, we might do all right. So what are your thoughts on Americans just having too much shit?
Well, I think we do. And I think we're very consumer based. We want the next thing. We need to have that. Don't wear the same dress twice. That kind of mentality, where we are constantly trying to one up other people with the things that we own, the nicer car, the nicer clothes, the whatever, the better watch, which I made that comment this morning. But in my head, watches don't cost 10 grand, right? You know, they do, but that's not something my priority. But I think that we are caught up in shopping addiction. I think it's a way to make ourselves feel better, going out and shopping. It's like an all-day event sometimes. And in some ways, I kind of understand that because quite a few years ago now, I was going through what I call a necessary divorce, and I didn't really have a great social support system. So I would find myself, hey, I'm going to go to the store. Why? I don't need anything. Oh, but there's this cute thing or that cute thing. And I kind of see where you can get caught up in, hey, this makes me the dopamine hit. This makes me feel better. This makes me forget my problems. And I think that's part of it. Like, we have issues and we don't know how to deal with them. So we find ways to fill that void, and that's with stuff and buying things. And I'm amazed by how many storage units we have, and I see what you're saying, they're going up all over the place. And I'm like, if I can't fit it in my house, maybe I don't need it. There's a thought. Maybe I don't need to pay. And speaking of storage fees, some people pay hundreds of dollars for their stuff in storage while they live in their car, or they can't pay rent or a mortgage because they're paying 8, 9, 2 grand a month for storage units. And I have met these people, and it's really sad that they're choosing their stuff over themselves. They're choosing to be homeless, basically, while they protect their stuff. And that kind of, I'm going to call it a mental illness, is really hard to overcome. And we do have too much stuff. And the hoarding issues come up in most other countries like ours, where we have stable homes, we have the means to fill them with too much stuff. And it can really lead to problems in relationships, because one person might be a clutter bug, the other person's a total neat freak. And people get divorces over this. Like, it really is that big of a deal. And until we start coming at it from that perspective, I think we're going to just keep seeing this being a growing problem. So, yeah, I think we are very stuck in consumerism.
I talked to one of my best friends, and he has a big guitar collection, and he was kept on shining them all nice and keeping them all clean and didn't play them until one day, his father passed, and he realized, these guitars may be important to me, but when I pass, my kids are just going to sell them and get them the hell out of the house. So I think a lot of people hold on to stuff. Oh, it's going to be valuable someday. But if it never gets sold, it's not valuable at all. And it's right. Just stuff. So, realizing, that little figurine that grandma had 18,000 years ago, if I can't sell it, it has no value to me. And I think a lot of us think, well, I'm going to keep this for remembrances, and the kids are just going to put in plastic bags, throw them away, or have a big garage sale. So your shit's not that important, people. Just want to let you know that. My shit's not that important. Your shit's not that important.
It's important to me, right? But it's not important to anybody else. And I look at some of the stuff that I have, and I'm like, nobody's going to care one day about this stuff. Like, when I moved about a year and a half ago, I went through that mental process of, I don't want to bring it. I don't want to look at it again. It's not going to fit in the decor of my new place. Like, I just don't want to deal with it anymore. And so it helped me to downsize considerably. But Would it be easy for me to get too much crap again? Too much furniture? Yes. But I'm really trying to be conscious of this isn't going to fit in my new whatever. Like I don't need it. And one of the ways to mitigate too much stuff is stop acquiring. So a lot of times people keep getting more and more things, but they don't get rid of anything. And that's why their space gets full. That's why they need a storage unit. That's why they get into arguments with their spouses or roommates, because of the stuff. And I do see less acquiring helps, but also understanding that sometimes things are trash. Like your stuff that's old containers that are plastic that are outside are dry rotted and they aren't something you can recycle. It is trash. It is garbage, debris. It is not something the recycling personnel want to see come down their conveyor belt because it's trash. But a lot of times, I've had this conversation with someone recently, they think they're trash. They believe they are trash. And we had a conversation about the fact that A, you're not, and B, you're a human being. This stuff is separate from you. But they are so enmeshed in that faulty mindset that someone told them when they were 5 years old that they're garbage, that they believe they're garbage too. And it's mind-boggling to me that someone could be so deeply unaware of the fact that they are separate from the garbage. But it's like you're ripping off a scab from someone who doesn't realize that this is separate from them. It just blows my mind. And it's sad. It's really sad for someone to walk around thinking they are worthless. Like that is any human that's telling you that, that is so wrong. Like you might screw up. We all do, but that doesn't make you worthless. That doesn't make you a non-human. Like that is just I almost have no words for how sad that made me in that conversation. And I'm like, wow, I don't believe that. Yeah, I think I felt like as a kid, if I moved things, it caused chaos and a hoard, right? But I got this feeling like the stuff was more important than me. And I did believe that, but I don't ever believe I thought I was equal to it. Right? Like I was still a human, still above that. I wasn't equal to the piles of stuff. But I see a lot of people that have severe hoarding, that's what they equate. They equate themselves to the stuff. And so if you are trying to deal with it, that's how arguments and anger. And last year I had to call the police because I was like, look, this gate's been locked for a week. I need to leave the property and you shouldn't be locking the gate so that I can't. That's just nuts. But anyway, but just recognizing that you are separate and a lot of people aren't going to want your crap. It's valid. It's valid that I don't want to fill my house with things I can't use or things that have no meaning to me. It's valid. It's a boundary for me to be able to say that. And if that other person gets upset, that's on them. It's my boundary. It's my house. I don't have to let your stuff in here. And I've had conversations with some older folks who are very upset that their kids don't want their grand piano or the China hutch or whatever. And it's like, you know, it's not their responsibility to take it. I realize that's upsetting to you, but it's not, they don't want it. And that's okay. Maybe you do. Maybe you want to sell it. Maybe you have a neighbor kid that want, like, who knows? But I see that we aren't as attached to some of those things as some of the older generation is. I mean,
Well, you know, I grew up in an Italian household, and we had nice china that we never ate on the china. It's been in the thing for like 30 years. If you don't use it, what good is having it? And that's I think that's where I'm starting to get to the point where if I have something, I want to use it. I want to enjoy it. But for me to have 800 t-shirts hanging up, it's not doing me any good if I'm never wearing them. You know what I mean? So I want to have what I have, but I want to enjoy and use what I have instead of having 8 cheap watches, have one decent fit watch. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And I think more quality over quantity.
And I think quality in our stuff, in our relationships, like I'm not looking for, like if you talk about networking, right? People want to race through whatever networking event. And I did that in the very beginning, but I wasn't satisfied. I aim for 3 good conversations. If I get more than that, great. But good conversations, good connections, like that's what I aim for, not this speed dating network stuff. And I think it's important to look at the fact that life is a special occasion. Like I'm not going to wait to use my good soap. I'm not going to wait to light that candle. Like I'm going to live right now, because a couple years ago when I was helping clean up some piles, there was literally a box of china that never got opened ever. My parents have been married 40 plus years, you know, at that point. My mom was a widow at that point. They never used it ever. And I'm like, no, I am not waiting to use my good china. I'm not waiting to, well, I don't really have good china anymore, but because I don't really care. But I mean, I'm not going to wait to use my special serving tray or whatever it is. Like, I'm not going to do that because, well, I don't live in the fear that maybe I won't be here tomorrow, but it's reality. I maybe won't be here tomorrow. And I'm going to enjoy right now whatever that is that's in front of me and not wait for someday. It's not on the calendar, right?
It's not a day to week.
Nope, it's not. And so I'm finding that it's okay to enjoy what you have and enjoy that moment. And even if it's a moment of clarity with the person you're trying to help that normally drives you up the wall, it's okay to enjoy that moment. You know, it's okay to go, okay, right now I'm going to enjoy this peace. I'm going to enjoy the lucidity. And then the next moment it may not be that. So I'm just learning how to navigate it so that I'm, you know,
today I decide, right? we get to decide.
We get to decide how we're managing our lives and the people, you know, the things that we have to do for people. So anyway, I appreciate the reminder that we get to decide how we're navigating the world and how we're showing up.
Yep. Yeah. I mean, because that's, you know, for me, you know, even in my podcast, you know, that's my tagline. You know, the 3 most important words in the English language are today I decide. Because once you make a decision, all you have to do is act upon it. And it's the squirrel that usually gets squashed is usually because he didn't decide. He didn't decide to go left or didn't decide to go right. He just decided to stay in the middle of the road and got his ass ran over. So I think sometimes we just have to make a decision to be the victor instead of being the victim.
Exactly. And that's one of the things I love about your podcast is it is about overcoming that and being resilient and making a new decision on sometimes a moment by moment basis, you know?
Yeah.
So how do people find you? Do you have any, you have a lot of interesting episodes already, but do you have any good stuff coming up that we need to make sure we...
I actually, I'm releasing episodes from a guy's name is TJ Bell. And he actually went from ex-convict and addict to now one of the top podcasters in the world. So that's going out today. Nice. Anybody can find me at Vertical Momentum Podcast. And, you know, for me, it's just about paying it forward every day. I try to make that decision that I made the decision on September 11, 2001, that I was going to stand in the gap for people that can't help themselves. And I'm still trying to do that every day, trying to, you know, let people know that it's okay not to be okay, but just, you know, if you're going through hell, just keep.
It's one of my favorite quotes. If you're going through hell, keep going. I think it's Sir Winston Churchill is attributed to that, but I know what hell feels like, and I know I don't want to stay there. So it makes a lot of sense to just keep putting one foot in front of the other. So I appreciate you coming on and talking about all this hard stuff, and I'll be sure to put your contact info in show notes, and just keeping on. You're doing great things, and today I decide. What are you deciding today?
Exactly. Thank you so much, sis. Love you.
Love you too.
If you or a loved one has a hoarding problem, let's work together on a solution.